my voice is going through a $400 microphone into my mixer and then being sweetened up by the mixer before you guys even hear it. So.
And who said money can't buy you happiness, right, Chuck?
That's right. And welcome to episode 27 of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel, we have a special guest rogue, Mike Clark.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You want to introduce yourself, Mike?
Sure. I'm Mike Clark. I run the Pragmatic Studio. We do Ruby and Rails training, and I'm also a Ruby Rails developer, and I've done some iOS stuff as well. So that's what I'm up to these days.
All right. Good deal. Also on our panel, we have Avdi Grimm.
Hello, hello.
All right. We also have James Edward Gray.
Hey, everybody. It's James. I'm sitting over here stroking my fluffy white cat thinking about how to take over the world.
We also have Josh Susser.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
And I'm Charles Max Wood. And let's go ahead and get started. This week we're going to be talking about teaching Ruby, and that's why we have the expert Mike Clark on here. So, Mike, why don't you go ahead and get us started with just some of your thoughts on teaching, you know, maybe some of the challenges that we face and things like that.
Oh, I knew you were going to do that, Chuck. Go ahead and get us started, Mike. No problem at all.
Okay, so
no pressure.
Let's be a little nicer to our guest.
All right, Josh, why don't you get us started?
Okay, I'll get us started then. I think this was my idea, this topic, and the my first Rails training was from Mike Clark way back when, and I think many of us have experienced like classroom setting teaching of Ruby, which is a big part of the topic. But I think there's also a lot of teaching of Ruby that goes on in our day-to-day stuff, especially if you're pair programming with somebody or mentoring new people, working on open source projects. So I think when I envision the topic, it was a little bit bigger than just classroom settings. But I think that there's a lot that we can learn from classroom settings that could be helpful to how we teach Ruby to people in our day-to-day interactions, or how we even learn it ourselves.
I think you brought up a really key point that I'd like to sort of start with, in that everybody learns in a different way, and some of those ways can overlap. You know, it could be classroom and pair programming. But, you know, our experience has been, you know, we do classroom training primarily because we're not on site with people in their project. But having someone to mentor them or pair program with back on the project in the context of their actual domain is really, really key. Because what you want to do after you get sort of like formal training is go actually build something. That's how you, you know, learn how to apply those things. So, you know, a lot of people think there's, you know, what one thing can I do to learn Ruby? And it's actually multiple things. It's sort of like a progression or a stage to go through. So we very much advocate, you know, learn it the way that works best for you, but also try different ways. Put yourself in different situations to do that learning, because that's gonna be the thing that really helps you grow as a Ruby programmer. So I think it's great to talk about all those different ways, not just classroom.
So do you have a favorite project that you kind of turn people loose on after you teach them?
Us? You mean during our training?
Uh-huh.
No, we don't. We actually turn them loose back on their project. I mean, most of our students are coming from an existing project in some company doing Ruby, primarily Rails, but some companies are still doing pure Ruby. And what they're looking to do is get skilled up enough from us that then they can go back and be productive on their project. So we generally tell people when they leave, the best thing you can do when you leave here is to go build something. Now that might be something, you know, you've got to do for your company, obviously. But if you don't have one of those, it could be something you've always wanted to build. You know, it might be a Rails app, or it might be a Ruby game, or you might play with some gaming library. But basically whatever excites you and is going to get you motivated is probably the best thing to start with. So we don't sort of like assign, go work on this project when you're done. We give people pointers. But you want people to be engaged in whatever they're doing, and they're going to be engaged in what they're excited about.
That makes a lot of sense. And that's something that I saw with my online course, because I taught an online course that just ended last week. And I kind of assigned them stuff. And I think it would have gone a little bit better if I had let them work on something that they were building themselves. And I do get questions from one guy that's still, you know, working on something of his own. But, yeah, I really like that idea and that approach.
So it's kind of interesting that Ruby conferences seem to be picking up on this training vibe, you know, and really starting to put training days in before the conferences. And sometimes they're run by, you know, professional companies like, you know, Pragmatic Studio and stuff. But a lot of times it's just, you know, people volunteer to teach a class on something for half a day or whatever. And I've done several of those myself. I was just thinking, Mike, what are your thoughts about those kind of informal trainings around the conferences?
I think it's a great idea. I mean, we did some stuff years ago before RailsConf. We did something called the Rails Guidebook. And basically the intent was, think of it sort of like a tour book or a tour guide where, you know, you want to like go to some foreign land and visit some foreign land and see what's going on. But you don't want somebody to just to like, you know, you show up at the airport and you're like, okay, what do I do now? You know, how do I get the most out of this trip? And so the intent was, you know, in this day before the conference, we'll show you all the sort of major attractions, introduce you to the language that you're going to hear sort of spoken around the conference, and just get people basically comfortable feeling like, oh, okay, I know where I want to go explore. I feel like I know enough about the language that I can communicate with people and, you know, not be embarrassed to do so. So I think it's a great way to basically bootstrap people into conferences, and more than that, help them get more value out of it overall. Because to the extent that they're that they feel part of that, because they're sort of knowledgeable, it just makes the entire community a lot better, and they're more productive during the conference too. So, I think it's a great thing. I think it can be tricky to pull off. I mean, I know people have approached us about doing some of those around different conferences, and it can be tricky because. If it's a long conference already, it means people are away from home for one more day, which can sometimes be a stretch for people. And they've already sort of committed a certain number of dollars to the conference. So, you know, we did ours basically as a charity where there was a small payment that you made, and then it went towards a number of charities. So I think you got to be a little bit careful about how much you charge for something like that. Although it's valuable, people are already sort of like the main thing is the conference. But it can be done, and it can be done really well and effectively.
Yeah, what I've noticed about doing them and stuff is, you know, it is a pretty wide range, and I personally enjoy that. Like, you know, you get some people who are just kind of, you know, showing little ideas or things they've done in their own projects and stuff like that. It can be good and interesting and stuff depending on what you're after. And then you get other people who's kind of surprising, you know, they're not typically in a training scenario, and they turn out to do real well. And so the content can be, you know, real varied and stuff. But I kind of like that, getting into some of the stuff I don't normally see.
So I'm kind of curious, because we've been talking about kind of the formal training aspect of teaching Ruby or teaching Rails. How did you guys learn? Did you guys have mentors? Did you pick things up just on your own, or, you know, off of blogs, or you know, what ways did you have for learning Ruby or Rails?
I had been doing Smalltalk for many years, and I had a little bit of background in functional programming, although I never really used it much in Anger. But picking up Ruby was pretty straightforward for me in terms of all the concepts, because it's a really good implementation of Smalltalk in a lot of ways. So I went out and I got the Pickaxe book and started reading that, and I just started, you know, I downloaded Rails and started playing around with that and building little apps kind of stuff. And then I was working at Earthlink at the time, and right when Mike and Dave started doing their Pragmatic Studio trainings for Rails, and brought them in and set up a 2-day training course, and I participated in it, and that, you know, I guess the rest is history.
James?
I did it sort of like Josh. I came mostly from the Perl world, and I grabbed a few keybooks and taught myself a lot of it. Also, back then, I came in the at the end of the era where the Ruby Talk mailing list was an absolutely phenomenal resource. So I spent a lot of time on that mailing list and interacted with a lot of first-generation Ruby folks. And so they were very kind and answered my questions and really got me over the hump. And that was how I picked it up.
I started reading the Pickaxe. I guess it was probably just when it came out. I was sort of tracking what Dave and Andy were doing, and I knew Dave and Andy before that. And I started reading it, and I guess I was sort of typical in the sense that I read it and I really liked the language, and I said, you know, what am I going to do with this? But I sort of kept playing around with it. Not to the degree that Dave did, and I'm talking about Dave Thomas, but I sort of just fiddled around with it, and I knew Dave, and I have to say, I mean, I really owe Dave all the credit for me getting into Ruby and Rails, because I knew him at the time, and I was able to ask him questions about Ruby, and I mean, he's just been an incredible mentor for me, you know, since then. And then I just pulled this up this morning, on March 18th of 2005, I guess is when I sort of committed myself to Ruby, in the sense that I knew enough about testing frameworks from other languages that I started basically writing what I called learning tests, which were tests written in test unit that weren't to test that Ruby was actually doing the right thing, because I knew that was the case. But it was a way for me to have a repeatable suite of tests that I could poke and prod on Ruby and see what it actually returned to me. So the story was, I read the Pickaxe, and the Pickaxe basically said, type this in and hit return and you should see this result. And I did that for enough pages that I finally said, you know what, I actually want to type that in once and I want to capture the result, and then I want to be able to go back and look at what it was. And so I wrote this blog post called Ruby Learning Tests, which was just basically how I learned Ruby, by writing little tests against things like string and array and hash and figuring out how they worked. And I just, you know, kind of snowballed from there and continued to get into it. And then when Rails came out, I was like, oh, I know what I can do with this now, because people want web apps. And I was fortunate enough to know some people who saw me playing around with Rails, and when we started doing teaching, hired me to build a Rails app for them. So my first Rails project was literally a production app back in the day.
So Avdi, how'd you pick up Ruby? Because I know you've been in the community longer than I have even.
So let's see. I read the Pickaxe. I've been a general language geek for a long, long time, and I was doing a lot of Perl for like data munching and stuff like that, and I was interested in other scripting languages, and this Ruby language started getting mentioned more and more in those communities. So I picked up a copy of the Pickaxe and tore through it.
So it's interesting that basically none of us seem to really pick it up via training, and yet now a lot of us have been involved in doing trainings for other people.
Yeah, I kind of came from a different angle, because before doing Ruby, I was actually a systems administrator. I didn't come in from another language. And really what it did it for me was, I was working with Rails developers while running a tech support department. And anyway, we needed a tool, and I'd done programming as part of my degree. I have a computer engineering degree, and so I could code. I just really didn't, and so I got into it and really started to enjoy it. And so my first language, my first framework, were Ruby and Rails. So just kind of an interesting thing there. And most of what I picked up was really from working with other people. It was more mentorship. I never have read the Pickaxe book. I have every intention of doing so, and I have it on my shelf, but, you know, ultimately it wasn't from the books. It was from the other guys that I was working with and the things that I learned from them.
So let's go back to the training scenario. When we end up in a room full of, people interested in learning more about Ruby, where do we go from there? Mike, I know you had some interesting things to say about this before the show, so.
You mean, where do you go from there after the training, or?
No. How do you start a training for Ruby folks? What's a good place to start?
Yeah, well, so you said you end up in a room, and I'll start there because we try to not make it so that you end up in a room. And we do that by, before you come to a class, actually giving you something to do, getting you into Ruby. And that includes installing Ruby. So we've got online instructions for how to do that. And it also includes like some recommended ways to get started. Because when you show up in the room, like you want to hit the ground running. So we try to actually bootstrap you into the training so that when you're there, you're getting the most out of it. But also that in a way, it sort of lets people get motivated about the language a little bit, and it lets them play around with it some, and it lets them form questions that they're going to have during the class. And, you know, we do that just by saying, you know, here's what we want you to do before class. Here's how to install Ruby. We want you to do a little bit of reading online. We want you to like type in some code and see what it does. You may not, you know, understand how it works, right? So that it's not completely like foreign and fresh when they get to the class. And I don't know. I mean, that's just the way that we do that. And so from there, it's, you know, in the early days, it was mostly people who had really strong programming backgrounds, mostly Java, you know, a lot of Java programmers. And as I said, when we were talking before, I think the easiest way to teach somebody something is to try to know and understand what they already know, and then try to figure out what they don't know and what they want, some motivation for what they want to do, and then basically do the diff, right? Like, so if you're a Java programmer and you really understand OO, then if I show you what a class is like in Ruby, you say, oh, well, that's sort of like, you know, a class in Java, except I don't have any like types, right? So then we can figure out, okay, well, the difference is it's a dynamic language. Let's talk about that. But it's always wrong to assume that Java programmers know anything about OO. They might know Java syntax, but they don't necessarily know object-oriented programming, right? They're orthogonal concepts, really. So then you have to step back and you say, oh, okay, well, the diff is, you know, in Ruby, you know, we've got these objects and we need to understand what they are because they're really powerful and classes are objects and all that stuff. So do that sort of diff. But these days, I think, and this is totally anecdotal, but we're seeing more and more people come into Ruby and Rails in particular that have no programming background, right? They're just like, I just want to, you know, I want to learn to program. So figuring out what they know about programming is pretty easy. Unless they've self-started, they don't know much at all, which is good in one way. They don't have a lot of baggage. They don't care about types. You know, they don't know what a type is. But it's bad in other ways in that you have to start like from the basics, which is, you know, before I, you know, I need to teach you about iterators. You need to know like what a loop is. Why would you want to loop over something? You know, what is a variable sort of thing? And that gets really hard because that's a huge curve. If you think about what's going on in Rails today and everything that goes into getting Rails installed in your first Rails app running, if you don't have that background, I mean, it's a pretty steep mountain. So especially in our public classes, it's tricky because you got to figure out, okay, you know, who in this class has a strong programming background and the diff is pretty small versus who are the people in the class where the diff is huge, right? And so you just kind of got to start with what do you know and what do you want to learn and really motivate them towards that. Because, you know, I hate taking classes where it's like, here's the syntax. What I want to know is why would I ever want to do that? You know, and so you figure out, well, what do you want to be able to do? You know, oh, I want to be able to have a method that does this. Okay, well, then let's talk about methods, you know, and motivate it that way.
So, Mike, what are the strengths of Ruby that you use to motivate people to learn it?
Well, so the strength there in terms of motivation is there's very little friction, right? If somebody says, hey, I want to be able to print out my name, it's like, okay, you know, put us your name. Let's start there sort of thing. Now, we don't do that in Rails. I mean, I would do that in a Ruby course. We can't start everyone in a Rails course at that level, which is why we try to prepare them beforehand to get into the course necessarily. But the fact that it stays out of your way means that people can get to where they want to go a lot sooner, and you don't have to explain, you know, a lot of this stuff. If you were, you know, the classic sort of joke is if you were having to, you know, show somebody how to print their name to the console in Java. You'd have to tell them about public and what static means and void and string and all this stuff, which they don't care about, right? It's like, okay, whatever. I just want to print my name. So I think the biggest strength of Ruby is that it's like principle of least surprise. You want to print your name? Type print, type put s your name, or type print your name if you want, right? And it just works. And that's huge. I mean, that is, I can't overstate how big that is for people.
So, Mike, you touched on a bunch of things there I found interesting. One was the people coming to our language now that don't have any experience and want to learn to program. I've seen some of that too. And the interesting thing I find is, I think Ruby is a little bit hostile to that crowd, in not in the language and stuff like that, more our community. And I think that's because, you know, we kind of grew up as a community of language geeks and stuff that kind of found it early. And I'm not sure we've done the best job in the world of preparing the beginner materials. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. That's a good observation. I don't know that that's true. And the reason I say that is because there's actually quite a bit of good stuff for beginners out there. I've heard from a number of beginning programmer sorts who would tell me that Wise Poignant Guide was a way for them to start. And for me, Wise Poignant Guide was confusing. It just wasn't the way I sort of wanted to learn. It was sort of this, you know, to me, it was sort of this, like, I know this is going to be like heretical to say, but it was sort of this like weird way to explain what's going on. I wanted sort of a more straightforward, but I had this programming background. So there was stuff like Wise Guide, you know, there were things like Shoes. There were, you know, there's the Learn to Program book. There's quite a bit of material for beginners, but I agree with you in the sense that these days the ecosystem is pretty big. And, I was thinking, like, Ruby was a lot easier back in 2005. You know, it was just like, it was Ruby. There were some gems out there. And you could get started pretty easily. And you didn't, I guess the thing would be, you didn't feel like you were an outsider because there weren't very many insiders. You know, there wasn't a really big sort of community. And I think if I were a Ruby programmer today or trying to learn Ruby and I went to a conference, it's not that people would make me feel an outsider, but I would feel like, wow, I got to, you know, like, I have to figure out how to work my way into this community if I'm going to get the most out of this. But I don't feel like Ruby or Rails has done anything overtly to, like, discourage people from doing that. I don't think, like, we've made it hard for people to install Ruby. I think we've made it easier for people to do things in Ruby and Rails, given that they already know what's going on. But in some ways, that makes it harder for beginners.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that being able to, or the materials that are around now for people to be able to learn Ruby are so much better. I actually first heard of Ruby in, I don't know, 2002 and tried to pick it up, but there wasn't much for me to look at and read, and I gave up pretty quickly. So now it's a completely different world, and people coming into Ruby have all the things you mentioned. There's Try Ruby, Kids Ruby, you know, tons of blogs out there and some really good training courses. So different kind of world.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to know, like, what would it be like coming in today? And that's hard to do, to sort of put yourself in their shoes, because all of us on this call have been steeped in this for so long, that you really have to step back when you're trying to teach somebody Ruby and say, okay, well, you know, sort of forget all that a little bit and just boil it down to, you know, let's talk about what you want to do, what you understand, what you don't, and go from there. But, you know, and in that respect, it can also be really fun for them, because there are certainly people who want an experience where they're going to learn something and it's going to take them into more areas, right? They're going to learn Ruby and they're going to become part of this community. And there are people out there that very much want that sort of social aspect, really. And it also shows them where they can go. They say, you know, I want to learn Ruby because I want to write a Rails application, because I want to go to RailsConf and give a lightning talk, because I want to, like, you know, be the next IPO, right? So there's an actual progression that they can see, which is kind of cool. I wouldn't recommend that progression, but
but yeah. it works for so many people.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, the points that you were making. I have a client that she basically tried to write. I mean, it was a really simple app too, but she tried to write this app in Rails, and you know, just was like, I just don't have the time or inclination to figure this out right now. So she hired me to build it for her, and you know, so when I gave it back to her so she could do the design work and stuff on it, we went through all kinds of stuff with setting up RVM and setting up Rails and doing all this other stuff. And, you know, and then she tied Rails admin onto the back end, and I customized some things on that for her. So she has her own custom fork. And so, I mean, we went through all of that too. And, you know, she's just like, there's so much to know. And I didn't even think about it. You know, for me, it was like, well, I thought this was real easy, you know, and I learned Rails probably 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, I was like, yeah, well, it was easy when I learned it, but you know, yeah, it's changed so, so much. And, you know, just to have to understand all the stuff that's out there with RVM and Bundler and Ruby Gems and everything else, it was really kind of eye opening for that. But then you get these other guys that come in and they just kind of seem to gravitate to it. Not even necessarily for the language sometimes, but for the community, like you were talking about.
Yeah. I mean, where we see people excel the most are people who have a real goal. You know, they want to do something, as opposed to people. And there's certainly nothing wrong with this, but I know people, and I've talked to people who will go to a class and they will read, you know, 5 books and then 10 books, and then they'll be out reading all these blogs all day long about Ruby, and they're learning stuff, but because they're not really applying it, it doesn't really stick, you know. And I always encourage people, find a way that works for you to get started, whether that's in the classroom, whether it's somebody at your company that can mentor you over lunch, whether it's reading a book. And then set a real goal, like, I want to write a program that's going to like record my favorite football scores, right? Because then that's going to motivate you to learn the next thing, because you're going to get to a point where you're going to say, oh, I want to store these in a database. Or even simpler, you know, oh, I want to use, you know, I want to store these in comma separated values, you know, okay, go learn, you know, the CSV library, or go learn Active Record. And then you have a real reason to go learn those things. And then when you're actually applying them, it sticks, because you remember that time where you wanted to save something in a database and you learned Active Record, for example. Because when you're just sort of like wandering around, picking up every bit of knowledge you can, there's no end to it. You don't know when to stop. You know, it's just sort of like, I'm reading it, but I don't know what this is really good for. So I think people excel when they have a real goal.
And all of those rabbit holes are so deep, right? If you, hey, you know, oh, I'll just learn a little Rails. Yeah, you can keep doing that for years, you know, so.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's something I've seen. I don't do a ton of training, but I have some basically tutoring engagements that I do. And that's something that I've seen is, you know, I think as a result of the fact that the Ruby community has largely kind of moved on from talking about the language itself so much into sort of talking more about the universe of technologies that surround the language, it can be very confusing for somebody coming in, and somebody can, and I've seen, you know, people can feel like they need to have an opinion over, like, whether they prefer Redis to CouchDB, you know, when really all they need to be working on right now is, you know, figure out how to use arrays. And so it can be, there is this feeling like you have to understand this huge ecosystem of technologies. And I think it would be helpful, you know, if there were a better sort of guide to, you know, perspective, you know, here's sort of the progression, things that you need to understand, and there are a lot of things that you really just don't need to worry about at first.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think there's something to be said too for tackling some of the hard problems. I mean, there are things that I've learned about different technologies and things like that because I went out and tried to figure out MongoDB or tried to figure out Cassandra or this or that, and you know, I think initially you're correct that, you know, yeah, don't worry about these other details. Do I use Couch or Mongo? But I think as you move ahead and you're trying to get into some of the more advanced or intermediate topics, eventually, I think you do need to figure out, okay, I'm going to dig into this and challenge my thinking in this way, or, you know, I'm going to open up this because it's different from what I've dealt with before and see what's new to learn there.
So I'm going to try to hijack the conversation here because Mike hit on something interesting earlier that I want to talk about. And that was, he kind of dismissed learning syntax with an offhand comment. And talked more about, you know, learning how to think about programming. And that's always been a very big deal in any teaching I've done. That I always feel like programming teaching is so, you know, syntax focused. So you want to learn Ruby, here's the, you know, here's how you define methods in Ruby and stuff like that. It's like, you know, that is the dumbest, easiest thing to learn that has nothing to do with programming, you know, that it's thinking about programming, learning to think about how machines work and stuff like that, and how they have to have the steps spelled out for them, and why do we have to, you know, when we want to change one line in the middle of the file, why do we have to make a copy of it and rewrite the first part, and then rewrite that one line and rewrite the last part, and then move it back over the first one, you know, it's things like that, learning to understand how those processes work that I think are so tricky. So, Mike, why don't you talk about, like, in your teachings, how do you handle the thinking about programming?
Yeah, and in terms of the syntax thing, again, if you're coming from another language, it's usually pretty easy, right? You say, oh, okay, here's how you write a method in this language, and here's the syntax in Ruby. And if you've got that background, you just say, oh, okay, I know that a method is going to have a name, and it's going to, you know, possibly take some parameters, and then you just sort of do the diff there. That's not real tricky to do. But there are times when people know how to write a method, but they don't really know what a method is for. And I don't say that to sort of like belittle what people know about Ruby. But when you step back and think about conceptually, as you're talking about, you know, a real question is, when would you write a method? And what should a method do? You know, how big should a method be? How small should a method be? What should it know about? When you pass things into a method, you know, what is good and bad coupling? You know, if you pass in too much, is that, you know, bad? If you pass in too little, does it have to ask other objects what to do, right? So the syntax is certainly one thing, and you can't sidestep it, because when you're teaching a beginner to write a method, if you were to start with the concepts, which is good, you know, and motivate them, here's why you want a method, you know, here's why we need to create a method right now. But if you gloss over the syntax, they kind of won't come along with you, because what they're looking at when they type that in just feels so foreign to them that they can't really get it conceptually until at least they feel comfortable enough about the syntax. But my experience has been, you want to show them the least amount of syntax possible to get them to the concept. So if I was teaching you methods, I would show you the simplest possible method. And then if we had to pass a parameter into that method, I would show you how to do that. But I would certainly not at that point say, by the way, here's a bunch of other stuff we could do. We could pass in a method that has a default argument. We could pass in a method that has a default argument that's based on the values of the previous arguments. You know, if the last argument is a hash, we don't have to, you know, put the curly braces on. That's where you lose people, because they're like, oh yeah, I don't care. I don't need that stuff right now, you know? So but that gets tricky too, because if you just create the simplest possible Ruby class, create some like person class with an attribute and like an initializer and a method. And if you sit back and look at it, if you try to explain that whole thing at once, it's difficult. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on there that's really easy to us, you know? If you get beyond just the class level syntax, if you had like an add or reader in there, right? You got to explain, you know, you may have to explain that it's not a keyword and the class is active. So when the class is being defined, code is actually being run. So there's a whole bunch going on in there that you want to get them comfortable with at some point. But if you overwhelm them with the syntax up front, they just get lost, you know, forest for the trees situation. So it's a delicate balance. It really is, in terms of how people pick up the syntax. I'm not necessarily a language wonk. I'm not, you know, I couldn't compare Ruby syntax to four other languages. In fact, I sort of forget all Java syntax I used to remember. So I'm not good at remembering syntax myself. Other people are much better than me at like remembering the sort of corner cases. I still look up corner cases, and I use them, you know, so sparingly that it's okay for me to just sort of forget about those things. So it's encouraging beginners that they don't need to know all the syntax to get something done. But when they do need to get something done, it's important for them to understand what they're doing and what it means.
So I've had a lot of success in trainings using kind of similar techniques. One thing I've done that really worked out well when I wanted to teach regular expression and Ruby's integration with that, like you said, you know, the syntax can really get in your way. And Ruby's regex system is kind of one of examples of that, because if you do like string and then the match operator and some regex, you know, in IRB, if you're trying to show examples or something, Ruby just returns a cryptic index there where that regex matched, you know.
Right.
And you have to explain, okay, this part's the, you know, match operator, this is what it does, and I hate that. So actually, one way I did it one time is I started an IRB session, and we'd already had a little bit of strings work, so we'd had, you know, indexing into strings with, like, indices to get the letters or a substring at some point. So I just used, you can index into a string with a regular expression, and it'll return the part of the string that matches that regular expression. And it turns out that's so much easier to teach and work with, because it's like you put in this pattern that describes something and it spits out the part of the string that matched that pattern, you know?
Right.
And so the syntax basically just goes away at that point. And then when I'm teaching regex, the way I do it is I don't even tell you what the operators of a regular expression are. I just show you examples. I'll show a bunch of examples in the class, you know, of things, and I'll start introducing like a period, and I'll show several examples of what it's doing, and the students will figure out what that does over time, and then I have them write it down on these, you know, whiteboards up in front, so when they basically learn what some operator is in a regular expression, and kind of puzzle it out that way, so that they're focusing on how things interact with each other, and I'm listening to them talk. And so if they, you know, get stuck on certain things, I'll try to show them a new example that looks at it in a different way.
Well, and that brings up, I mean, something that makes teaching a lot more fun and easier for people is IRB, which, you know, now that we've used it for years, we're just used to having IRB at our fingertips. But the real key to IRB, I think, is that when students go into IRB, for some reason, the sort of switch in their brain that says, I'm doing something real, I don't want to screw up anything, it goes off. So they feel like they can actually experiment. Like when you open up a text file and you start writing a real program, people are sort of afraid to do something. Like, well, if I type in the wrong thing, is it going to blow up? Right? In IRB, for some reason, it just feels like, go ahead, experiment, see what happens. You know, take an array and, you know, do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really cool, and it's super easy to discount, but I think there are two different personalities happening. When you're in IRB, you're experimenting, and you can actually learn. And for some reason, when you're in a program file, you feel like you've got to do the right thing all the time.
So we've been talking a lot about like teaching beginners and not really much about teaching more advanced people. But one of the techniques I like, either for beginners or for getting more advanced people to level up, is blowing their mind, and where you just show them something that is gonna, you know, make them think, wow, I, you know, what is that about? How does that work? Wow, that would really change how I'm doing something in, you know, day to day. I mean, you know, the Rails 15-minute build a blog video was one of those blow their mind kind of things. But there's a lot of little ones that you can do when teaching, and I'm curious if people like doing that or what they fall back on. I like things like the enumeration protocol. That, you know, just showing someone partition usually blows their mind enough that they're willing to learn anything about all the collection methods and all that. Yeah. So there's just a lot of little go-to things that I like dropping in on people and say, oh, look, you can do this. And they're like, what? And then they'll pay attention for a few minutes as you teach them something boring.
That's the key. I mean, and I actually like the name, the blow your mind pattern, if you want to coin that.
go ahead.
Because when you're learning something, you want little wins along the way, right? So you kind of want to stage it where it's like, I give you a little win and then you rule. And then, you know, you get another little win and you can do it. And you do a series of these. And at some point you go, you know, I really rule. I can do this, right? But you sort of get a little lackadaisical too, like, oh, I'm getting all this. So after a series of those sort of I win moments, it's okay, I think, to do a, okay, now I'm going to blow your mind moment, because that's going to get you to the next series of I rule moments, because you're going to say, wow, I want to learn how to do that now. Okay, well, let's step back and look at what that actually is, so that at the end of that next series, you know what's going on. But then you want another, like, okay, let's, you know, what do you want to do? Let's blow your mind. So I think that's okay to do to beginners at a certain stage, not like the first day. But I think it's definitely something very effective for advanced people, because people love to sort of like continue to level up. And that's one way to do it, is to figure out, Josh knows something really cool and just showed me, and I want to do that too.
Yeah, I think that kind of gets back to IRB a little bit. Mike was talking about how, you know, when you're in the program, you know, you feel like it's a different scale and scope and stuff. One of the things I worry about once I've opened a text file is, where do I stop? You know, like, how much do I have to write before I can run this thing and see what it does? And the great thing about IRB is you already know the answer of that question. It's at the end of the line, right? When you write that whole line, it stops and you get immediate feedback and those little successes, you know, and success is addictive, like Mike was just saying. Right. you get those little victories along the way. But I definitely agree with the blow your mind strategy. I can still remember one of the coolest things I saw in Ruby back in my early days. And I can't remember who showed it to me, unfortunately, but we were working with RexML stream parser. So you pass it some object and then it reads an XML document and it calls methods on that object as things happen, like, you know, tag start, tag end, that kind of thing. And, you know, documentation was terrible, as, you know, we're unfortunately famous for. And so we had no idea what to do. And someone showed me, they just defined a class and put method missing on there to just print out what was being called. And they passed that object into RexML and fired it off. And so we basically just got this printout of tag start with blah, 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 you know, and it taught us the interface because of this one little trick he did. And I thought that was a great blow your mind moment.
Yeah, you got to love those. And sometimes it's real simple. You're pairing with somebody and you just get something really, really simple. But, you know, you use it over and over and over again and it makes a huge difference. All right, well, let's get into the picks. I hate cutting this off. Maybe we'll have to do another episode on this and have Mike come back, because I really feel like I'm cutting this short. But we need to keep this to an hour. So why don't we do picks, and we'll start with Avdi.
All right, just one, I think. Ruby 1.9.3, which is now released, and there's lots of good stuff in it, but I like it just for file.write, which, since, you know, I've been using file.read for years, it just it feels natural. Actually, I have an anti-pick too. The Plantronics 995 wireless headset, which I wasn't happy with for a while, and I got, you know, based on a bunch of recommendations, and it seemed like a great headset for like remote pairing and stuff like that, because it's comfortable and it's a nice long lasting battery and stuff. Well, it just died on me today while I was getting ready for this broadcast, and it's like 1 month out of warranty, so I don't think I'm going to be recommending the Plantronics wireless headset anymore.
All right, so that's an anti pick, I guess.
We feel for you, Avdi.
Don't buy that. It's bad. All right, Josh.
Okay, on to me. Great. Okay, so my first pick is testfirst.org. And that's all about test-first teaching of Ruby. Sarah Allen and Alex Chafee did a talk about this at GoGuruko in 2010. And the video for that is up there on Confreaks, I guess. But testfirst.org has good resources for how to use or how to do teaching based on test-driven development. And we didn't get a chance to talk about that during the episode today, but I figured I'd throw that in there as a pick. So feel free to go check it out and look at the video, videos on the site, et cetera. My next pick is Maglev. So this has been a long time coming, but Maglev is now 1.0. And for people who aren't familiar with it, Maglev is it's a Ruby implementation built on top of the Gemstone Smalltalk virtual machine. And Gemstone has some pretty cool persistent object technology. So it's essentially Ruby running on top of a distributed NoSQL database. And it's pretty high performance. We haven't seen benchmarks published since the release yesterday, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. A year ago, it was faster than everything except JRuby. So see how that goes. I think it's worth checking out. I'm going to be playing around with it some in the next week to see how it is now that it's all grown up in 1.0. And then I have a quick fun one, which is the Ancient Inventions documentary series. And this came out a while ago. I think it was the late 90s. But Terry Jones of from Monty Python is the narrator and host of this, and it's like 2.5 hours of stuff in 3 episodes. It was a BBC documentary all about the brilliant things that inventors did thousands of years ago and how a lot of our modern conveniences compare to those things. So I think it's worth checking out. I've been watching it on Netflix streaming, but it's out on DVD and other formats as well. So that's it.
All right. James.
Okay, so I've been working on some new apps, and in that I've had to do some interactions with email and trying different services, and I've had quite a bit of success lately with SendGrid, so I wanted to recommend SendGrid to people if you need to send out email, and really, if you're Rails app sending email and stuff, you should absolutely never be using, a local... I'm sending it to, I'm totally blanking.
Send mail?
Yeah, send mail, postfix, I'm sending it to, a local queue and sending it out. As great as that can be, it's just, you eventually run into email deliverability errors or issues, and it's so much work to work around those that, it's just not something you ever want to do. So pay somebody else to solve all those problems for you. And, SendGrid is my current weapon of choice in that area for getting it done. And they have a new newsletter API on SendGrid, which I've been making use of in one of my apps. And I like it. It's not perfect, and there are things I would add to it. There's a couple little issues, but it's a good start. And so you can... using this newsletter API, you can create newsletters and send them out to a bunch of people at once instead of, having to iterate and fire off, 40 emails or something. So I really like that. And if you do want to play around with that newsletter API, my local Ruby users group has a OKRB, OKRB is the group. We have a gem called Gatling Gun, which will fire out those emails for you. And it's really new gem. We just got it together, so it's not robust or anything, and it still needs a lot of work, but I am using it in production, and it's effective and working. So you might want to check out those two things.
All right. Yeah, those guys around James are pretty okay, and they wrote a pretty okay gem, so okay.rb. Anyway, Mike.
My first pick would be the Redcar Ruby editor. It's an editor written in Ruby. It's free. It does great Ruby syntax highlighting. We started using it during training because we found people would bring editors they weren't really comfortable with. We were using TextMate and Vim, and then other people, unfortunately, would try to use things like WordPad and TextEdit. And Redcar runs on Mac, Windows, and Linux, and it's really well done. And the guys who put it together are super friendly. They've put a lot of work into it. So I just wanted to give them a little bit more press. I liked it so much, I put together a little 12-minute screencast on how to use it. It's also free. So we've been getting a lot of mileage out of Redcar, and I just want to thank those guys for putting it together. My second pick would be, just to be a little different, is an iPhone app that I got turned on to called Instacast. And I don't listen to a ton of podcasts, but when I do, trying to transfer them from iTunes over to my phone is a real hassle. With Instacast, you just subscribe to a podcast like the Ruby Rogues, and then it just downloads it to your phone. And then when new podcasts come up, it'll automatically download those. So get your Ruby Rogues podcast through Instacast. I don't know who built that, but it's a slick little app.
That's great. I've been looking for something like that. Cool.
Yeah, I've used it off and on. The problem that I've had with it is that I like to be able to queue up my podcasts in a playlist and then play them, and I couldn't figure out how to do that with Instacast. But
why did I never have that idea? Chuck, I could kiss you.
Yeah. Okay. I'm a little disturbed now.
Awkward.
Anyway, so my picks, a couple of picks here. The first one is a little bit ago I picked Balloon Tower Defense 4, and the guys over at Ninja Kiwi have actually put it out as an iPhone app, and so I've been playing it on my iPad lately, and it's just been a whole lot of fun, just really interesting little game. Another pick that I have that I want to put out there, and this has been around for a while, but I've been listening to the Ruby Show, and that's done by Jason Seifer and Peter Cooper, and some of the stuff they mention, I'm just like, yeah, whatever, but every once in a while, they really have just some solid news that I didn't hear, and it's nice to kind of keep your finger on the pulse of what's going on in the community with that podcast and the Ruby 5 podcast, so... just wanted to mention them just because I think they're funny guys. And anyway, so that's kind of a good podcast. And those are my picks. So if you want to get the Ruby Rogues podcast, you can. You can find them at iTunes. We're also, like Mike said, you can get us on Instacast. There are a few other ones out there that I haven't submitted us to. Some of you have to submit to. And some of them are like Instacast where you just put in the podcast name and it'll find it. So, you know, we also have a lot of people on Android listening through Listen. So if that's your thing, then you can get us there as well. I really appreciate the reviews. We actually had, last time I looked, 51 reviews, and 48 of them were 5-star, which is really cool. And I really appreciate all the people who have taken the time to leave feedback. So,
yeah, and that's, you know, that's not costing us that much money, you know, so I think it's very worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, anyway, that's about all we've got this week. Next week, it's going to be a live recording from Ruby Midwest, and James is going to be heading that up, so we're all looking forward to that, and then we'll catch you in a few weeks.